From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Two very different types of reporting on today's edition of Fresh Air. Neurologist Oliver Sacks reports on his patients in case studies. His most celebrated case study is about a man who mistook his wife for a hat. Eli Reed is a photojournalist. He wondered how the residents of Beirut managed to go about their daily lives surrounded by constant fighting. He risked his life to find out. Also, we feature Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad in our weekly performance spot. And Ken Tucker has a review of the new home video, So You Want to Be a Gambler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Dr. Oliver Sacks is a neurologist who describes himself as a reporter of the human condition in extremis. His patients have severe neurological disorders such as aphasia, Parkinson's disease, and Tourette's syndrome, disorders which have deprived them of memory, movement, cognition, or sensation. Dr. Sacks' case studies of his patients penetrate to the moral, spiritual, and psychological dilemmas brought on by these disorders. Much of his work has been done with patients who live in the back wards of charity hospitals and asylums, people whom the medical profession had given up on. In the late 60s, Sacks began his work with victims of sleeping sickness who gave the appearance of living statues. He awakened them from that state by administering the then-new drug L-DOPA. His 1973 book about this work, Awakenings, was recently published in a new edition. Sacks' latest book, the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, was adapted into an opera of the same name by the British composer Michael Nyman. On July 14th, it received its New York premiere. I spoke with Oliver Sacks last summer when the American Music Theater Festival presented the American premiere. Sacks told me about the patient in the title story. He was a music teacher and singer who didn't recognize that he had a disorder. These were some of his symptoms.
Well, the first problem was that he had difficulty recognizing his students at the music academy. As soon as they spoke, he recognized them at once, but he couldn't recognize them visually. And soon he couldn't recognize anyone or anything visually. He couldn't recognize his wife, he couldn't recognize himself, he couldn't recognize common objects. He saw them perfectly clearly, but what he saw carried no meaning for him and no sense. And this prompted him to sort of ingenious but sometimes wild and sometimes absurd guesses as to what he might be seeing.
And you titled the case study The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat because in reaching for his hat, he reached for his wife's head by mistake.
When I saw him in the first interview, he was obviously not demented, but a delightful, intelligent, civilized man with a sense of humor. He kept encountering the fact that he made mistakes, but he didn't recognize what the problem was. And it mixed with all his intactness. There was a succession of absurd mistakes. At one point, he confused his left foot with his shoe, and he didn't seem to know which was which. And then right at the end, when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head instead.
What is the condition that he had?
Well, this is called a visual agnosia. And what happens is that the normal meeting between visual input, between images and a person's memories and ideas and feelings and expectations doesn't occur. And so, and this always goes, this goes with a problem in the visual association areas at the back of the brain. And so he sort of had raw vision, a sort of raw seeing, which didn't ascend into the realm of meaning.
Although he couldn't make sense of what he saw, he was a musician and singer, and he still had perfect musical sense. And your prescription to him was music. Why?
He was really absolutely lost in this meaningless, shattered visual world. And he desperately needed some way of organizing himself. Now, I think all of us tend to either use internal speech or internal music to organize ourselves to some extent. I mean, one has things like nursery rhymes, one, two, buckle my shoe, or marching songs or work songs. But the song, as a unit of organization, became tremendously important and crucial for this man, who was so totally lost visually, couldn't use any visual organization, but in fact was a marvelous musician and singer, and a man who sort of generated songs all the while. And one saw again and again that he couldn't dress, he couldn't shave, he couldn't eat, unless he really set the activity to music internally. On one occasion when he was eating, there was an interruption, there was a sudden, the postman suddenly knocked at the door, and this completely shattered the activity, and he looked quite bewildered for a few seconds until he was able to recapture the melody of eating.
You know, your prescription of music reminds me of something that your friend the poet W.H. Auden had said to you, which is that, he spoke of the poetic and religious states of affliction. And I wonder what you think, how that applies to your work, the poetic and religious states of affliction.
I thought you were going to actually quote one of Auden's favourite quotations from Novalis, where Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem, and every cure is a musical solution. And certainly with Dr. P, as with many of my Parkinsonian patients, who are people sometimes who can't move unless they sing or dance. You know, one sees absolutely they've been unmusicked by disease and can be re-musicked back into health. I think that the poetic and the religious are almost sometimes an integral part of patients' perceptions as to what may be happening with them. Something I describe in the Hat book, and also at more length in an earlier book, A Leg to Stand On, as a patient whom I saw as a student, who had apparently lost his left leg. He was found on the floor, very bewildered. He'd apparently thrown himself out of bed in a peculiar way. And the story he gave was that he had woken up from sleep. He had found that there was a foreign leg in the bed with him. Disgusting object. He threw it out. And then, and now horribly, he had come out with it, and now it was attached to him. And I said, But it's your leg. And he said, you know, shouldn't I know my own leg? And I said, yes, you should. And he said, well, I know it's not my leg. Now, this thing for him was not only was terribly wrong. It felt ugly. It felt hateful. It felt obscene. It felt unholy. It felt an offence against nature. The particular physiology in his case was that he had a tumour in the opposite side of the brain, which had expanded while he slept and had blotted out the part of the brain which represents the leg. So the leg image had been obliterated. Therefore, he could not recognise his leg as his own. Therefore, it seemed absolutely other. But the absolutely other always seems uncanny and horrible and obscene and unholy and God-forsaken. And words like this or concepts like this will be used by every patient, irrespective of background, of intelligence, of education. The alienation is almost intrinsically in the area of subjectivity is sort of felt as anti-poetic, anti-religious. And by the same token, when it comes back, there's the feeling, to quote Dante, of the holy and glorious flesh restored. And so I think even at this level, sort of the body in health is always felt as sort of as beautiful and holy, although one may not appreciate this unless it's taken away and one suddenly deals with a radically depreciated world.
Your way of writing case studies is really very literary. It's not empirical. It's not cut and dry. You're really describing states of mind as well as neurological conditions. And I've wondered if patients talk to you that way, or if they are as descriptive as you are in telling their stories.
I think, obviously, this will depend on the condition and the patients, but above all, I think on the situation, in that if a patient is not permitted, implicitly or explicitly, to talk about himself, if he's reduced, if he's given a sort of catechism, do you have this, do you have that, then he will reduce himself to a list of symptoms. He won't say what is actually like. He won't depict the world he is in, which he's been thrust into. But I think that if patients have a complaint, sometimes more serious or as serious as their primary complaint, is that they can't communicate what it's like. And I think that a major act of the doctor is somehow to, De Quincey once talked about the pressure of the incommunicable upon the heart, is to let the patient try and communicate, and the doctor must sort of help him, must reach out to delicately to assist this trembling communication. And so that between them, the way it is, the world of illness can come into being.
You've done a lot of your work on backwards of hospitals, charity hospitals, asylums. Why have you gone there looking for the kinds of cases you are interested in studying?
Well, it was really not quite in that order. I was there.
Uh-huh.
In places which most of my colleagues wouldn't be seen dead in, and which no ambitious young doctor would go to, and which are felt to be the sticks. But in fact, here there is there's the priceless gift of leisure. There's no pressure to diagnose, there's no pressure to do anything. Also, you can encounter a complete world. I mean, these places are really little worlds. And I think that an unpressed exploration of getting deeper and deeper is possible in such places. It's hardly possible in any other places.
There's no pressure because they're considered hopeless anyways?
Partly. This was well realized by the founders of neurology, by Hewlings, Jackson and Charcot in the last century. They spent much of their lives in chronic hospitals, institutions, asylums. But now doctors don't. But certainly with the patients I describe in Awakenings, these people who had been in hospital for 40 years or more since the great sleeping sickness epidemic, I had no idea that such patients existed, that such lives existed, until I went into a chronic hospital.
Has that happened other times too, that you found disorders that have not really been described before?
Well, certainly they haven't been described with the richness and the fullness which they should have. In general, I think description has become sort of obsolete.
You've described it as almost a 19th century
yes.
art in medicine.
Yeah. I love 19th century medicine and science. It may have been so short in a way on certain empirical remedies and even relatively short on physiological concepts, and of course very short on technology, but the respect for the patient and for the detail of what was happening to them, I think, could often generate novelistically rich and at the same time sort of medically and scientifically accurate descriptions. So much so now that there's major discoveries have been made by going back over 19th century descriptions. Now we can see what went on. I think most of the descriptions now are so meager, so threadbare, and also so they're too quick to diagnose, to pin labels on.
When you're working with patients who have been almost abandoned by the medical profession, it's just a kind of caretaking type of thing, are you able to do anything to really change their condition, or are you more interested in observing them? And let's leave out the sleeping sickness patients, because
yeah, sure.
You were able to administer
yes.
a new drug there that totally changed their condition. But in other cases where there isn't a drug that's going to change their state, what can you do?
Well, There's a sort of doubleness between, the investigator and the physician. And sometimes they can go beautifully together. Sometimes they can sort of interfere with each other. But my first notion is to try and understand, with the patient what's going on. I recently retitled my first book, Understanding Migraine. It's not treating migraine, it's understanding it. Now, from the understanding, treatment may come. So that, for example, with one case I describe in the Hat Book, as I call it for short, as a Parkinsonian man who leant grossly to one side, although he wasn't aware of this. He was surprised that people commented. I took a videotape of this, I played it back to him, and it was only when he saw this that he realised what was happening, and he then asked a very acute question. He said he wondered whether there were balancing mechanisms. He used to be a carpenter, like spirit levels, like bubble levels, in the head, which had been impaired by his disease. And I said, yeah, exactly. And he then thought again, and he wondered if one couldn't make such little levels outside the head, for example, attached to by a nose clip to the glasses, and whether this would serve to balance him. And I said, oh, it's a wonderful idea, let's try it. And in fact, it worked beautifully. Now, here is a man who, all I did, in a sense, was to...
Give him a metaphor.
yes, I, did, right? Or he gave himself a metaphor. No, I assisted his understanding and indeed his movement to a cure. I mean, I love this sort of collaboration when it's possible.
I want to talk with you about some of the current work that you're doing. But first we're going to take a short break. My guest is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, whose books of case studies include Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks is my guest. Now, lately, some of the work you've been doing is in communities. Instead of looking at individuals with disorders, you're looking at communities that have a high level of disorders within them.
I've just actually come back from Canada where I saw, I was in a village, a Mennonite community in northern Alberta, where a third of the people have a thing called Tourette's syndrome with sudden convulsive movements and exclamations. I've seen individuals with Tourette's and I've written about them, but I've never sort of seen a community which had to grapple with this.
It seems very inexplicable to me that there'd be a community
here there's in this community there's a genetic basis, and with intermarriage it's become commoner. I'm reminded somewhat of a there was on Martha's Vineyard, there was a hereditary deafness for more than two centuries, and the rest of the community responded by learning sign. And in fact, sign became native to everyone, and it became oddly difficult sometimes to find out about the deafness. A woman called Nora Ellen Gross wrote a very beautiful book about this and described how in interviews she would say, was so-and-so deaf? And so-and-so might be remembered as a good friend or a fisherman, a joker, a prankster, a scholar. But was he deaf? Come to think of it, people would say, come to think of it, he was deaf, except one never thought of it. You know, he was just the same as everybody else. Up in this place in Canada, partly people are not seen as having Tourette's. They say, sure, you know, grandmother twitched a bit and made faces and noises, but that's only natural. But in here, one moves into a sort of clinical anthropology as to what the whole community is like, what it is like to have Tourette's in Le Crete, what it is like to be deaf in Martha's Vineyard or some of the other places in the world where there are many deaf people, and how disease is conditioned by culture and community and vice versa.
Do people see their diseases differently when there's people around them who share it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, one is not singled out and one is not set apart in the same way. And to some extent, it almost becomes, as it were, our, you know, the way we are, or else it ceases to be seen as a disease. And which was very clearly the case in Martha's Vineyard, where, you know, where in fact the deaf were as able as everyone else, and on the whole better educated than anyone else. They all went to the American Asylum, and the lawyers and others on the, you know, were all deaf.
I'm interested in how you developed the sense of empathy that I think it's clear you feel with the patients who you work with.
I think I was very slow to do it. My own approach was through the natural sciences. I was first had a passion for physics and later biology and later physiology. I only sort of got to individuals relatively late, you know. I think that if one listens, I think one has to restrict the urge to do something straight away. You may indeed need to do something, but you've somehow got to listen first, and then you will be given predicaments. You're presented with human predicaments and stories of how it is. And I don't know, these are heartbreaking, these are funny, they're absurd, they're tragic. They're often all of these at once. I think some neurological predicaments are both dreadful and funny. And again, patients may often have an extraordinary sense of humorous detachment. Some of this comes in with Dr. P and the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Something really awful is being described, but it's also funny in a way.
Sure, it has elements of slapstick in
yes,
it.
Yes, oh
really.
Sure, and Dr. P knew this. I mean, one talks about spoonerisms, you know. Spoonerisms were invented, if you want, by an elderly academic at Oxford, Dr. Spooner, who had a stroke, became aphasic, and tended to confuse words and say thud and blunder instead of blood and thunder. But he then, in a sense, exploited his own condition humorously and made an art of his disability.
You know, some people wouldn't allow themselves to admit to the humor in a situation like that because it would be perceived as laughing at someone who had a problem.
Well, he, of course, it's not laughing at them. It is bringing humor as one can bring poetry to the way one is.
You, the way I understand it, had a migraine problem when you were younger.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if that helped you be sensitive to the kinds of problems you've encountered as a doctor.
I think among my earliest, some of my earliest experiences, there was a family thing, was when I was about 3 or so, there would be visual migraines in which the appearances of objects would change and perhaps half of them would disappear, or sometimes they would appear unrecognizable. And when I came later to write my migraine book, perhaps a rather larger portion than one might expect deals with visual disturbances, and I think this again leads right on to the story of Dr. P's agnosia, and say a patient I'm seeing at the moment, a gifted painter who suddenly lost all colour vision and sees in black and white. But I'm very, very fascinated by perceptual change. And I think I, as you suggest, I was probably sort of sensitised to this. When I was very young, I was forced to realise that vision, the world isn't just given to one in its form and colour and movement and meaning, but in some sense it has to be constructed, and the eyes and the brain have to work right, otherwise one is in trouble. And another thing which struck me very much as a child was how if one closes one eye, the world immediately becomes flat.
Yes, yes.
Flat as a pancake. For some reason, I have very sharp stereoscopic vision and feel slightly disabled if I close one eye. But although I'm sort of... So I could never ignore the effects of the nervous system and of one's physical being. And at the same time, I always want to know the resonance as a physical being in being a person and perceiving and thinking and feeling and acting the way one does.
Well, I've always found that it's easier to see the larger things about the human condition in someone else's illness than it is about your own.
Yeah.
And when I'm in pain, I'm just thinking about the pain and not about the larger implications of it. I wonder if you're able to see the larger meaning when you have a problem, as you can see it when you're studying a patient who has a problem.
I don't know. The somewhat confessional book I wrote, A Leg to Stand On, is about being a patient with an alienated leg, and trying to communicate this, and failing, and feeling sort of rather hopeless, and then a sort of horror about this, which I couldn't communicate, and then the magic, the absolute wonder when it came back, and the way in which the gratitude and the delight, the incredulity, the convalescent. And I'm both sorry and glad that I had that experience, but I sort of try to explore it. But it was difficult, and that book obsessed and obstructed me for 10 years. I found it infinitely easier to write about other people.
You find all these implications about the arts in the work that you do, and several artists have been inspired by your work to do plays or operas based on it. There's an opera based on the man who mistook his wife for a hat. There's a Harold Pinter play inspired by Awakenings. What has it been like for you to see your case studies transformed into art?
First and last, it's very strange. It's rather startling and in a way wonderful to have one's own experiences and one's former patients brought to life again, so that I will suddenly see Dr. P again in the Hat opera, and or seeing my patients come alive in the play of Awakenings. Sort of in writing, it seems to me that in a sense I convert patients, people, and events into words, and now they're being converted back.
Oh, back into people.
back into people. Yeah, back into events, and one can, as a writer, you can only say things on stage. You can show it specifically with Dr. P. One can show him being organized by music. You could only show this, in a sense, on stage and with music.
We only have just literally a couple of seconds left, but one of the people who's meant a lot to you in your life, A.R. Luria, who was a neuropsychologist, talked about combining the empirical and the romantic, or the classical and romantic, mm-hmm. in his work. Do you feel that's what you've been striving to do also? I haven't left you any time to answer this.
absolutely. When I once asked Luria what he saw as his central enterprise, he said he couldn't say it in one word, but he had to use two, and he said romantic science. And I would say, hopefully, exactly the same of myself.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Oliver Sacks is a neurologist and the author of the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. The opera of the same name, based on his book, just opened the Sirius Fun Festival at Lincoln Center in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with horror film director George Romero. His debut film, Night of the Living Dead, was about flesh-eating zombies, and it became a cult classic. His new film is Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Photojournalist Eli Reed risked his life to bring back pictures of the war in Lebanon, pictures that show the city's transformation from resort town to war zone. Those pictures make up Reed's new book, Beirut, City of Regrets. Coming up, we talk with Eli Reed. Also, we have a couple of songs from Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad. And Ken Tucker has a review of a new home video designed to stack the deck in your favor. It's called So You Want to Be a Gambler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Nicaraguan Ambassador Carlos Tunerman left Washington today. Tunerman announced that he would comply with a U.S. departure order less than 3 hours before an administration-imposed deadline. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Nicaraguan Ambassador Carlos Tunerman was in a defiant mood, charging the Reagan administration with being an incredible obstacle to better relations with his government. Tunerman maintained that the U.S. had no legal right to expel him because he is also accredited as Nicaragua's envoy to the Organization of American States. And as host country, the U.S. cannot legally order its ambassadors to leave. He was asked why he did not choose to legally contest the issue here in Washington.
We think that the U.S. administration could use this as an argument against us and could use that in order to continue its aggression against our people.
Tunerman says Nicaragua will take its claim to the legal committee of the OAS. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Iran is no longer asking for the UN Security Council to condemn the United States for shooting down an Iranian airliner earlier this month. Iran's new stand apparently stems from a lack of support among the Council's 15 members for the country's original request to condemn the U.S. In a speech to the Security Council today, Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati said only that his country wants the U.S. to accept responsibility for the disaster in which 290 people were killed. Velayati also said Iran would accept payment to the families of the victims. The Moscow embassy will begin issuing refugee visas again next week. Earlier this month, the U.S. embassy stopped giving visas to Soviets seeking political refuge in the United States, saying money in the State Department refugee fund had run out. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The State Department has managed to scrape together enough money to relocate 400 urgent cases, most of whom are Armenians. These Armenians had sold their personal possessions and come to Moscow, anticipating that final documents to enter the United States would be granted instantly. But those who turned up at the embassy earlier this month were told they would have to wait until October 1st, when new relocation funds would be available. It was handled badly, admitted one U.S. official. In an appeal to President Reagan, a group of senators said the Soviets could now say it's the U.S. which hampers emigration, not the Soviet Union. U.S. officials say there is still not enough money to process 3,000 more Armenians who've also applied to emigrate. Most will still have to wait until the new fiscal year. But officials say they will seek private funds for those who are in particularly difficult circumstances. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Troops patrolled Yerevan Airport today after what residents described as an explosive reaction to a Soviet TV film broadcast last night. The news report showed Armenians protesting over the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute and characterized them as hooligans. There are conflicting stories about the nature of the trouble at the airport, but the Soviet national airline Aeroflot said all flights in and out of Yerevan had been delayed and the situation remained confused. Nagorno-Karabakh is currently controlled by the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The Supreme Soviet is scheduled to meet Monday to discuss demands that the region be returned to Armenia. Polish Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa today expressed praise and disappointment with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Speaking to reporters in Gdansk, Wałęsa praised Gorbachev's endorsement of national sovereignty during his current visit to Poland. However, Wałęsa said he had hoped Gorbachev would discuss pluralism in the Eastern Bloc, a subject Wałęsa said he'd like to discuss personally with the Soviet leader. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 15 points to close at 2129.27. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We have some Brazilian music on this week's Performance Spot with guitarist Orlando Haddad. Orlando grew up in Brazil. He moved to the United States in 1974. Since then, he and his wife Patricia have led a band named Minos, named after the place in Brazil where he was born. The best known and most widely recorded Brazilian popular song is probably Antonio Carlos Jobim's hit, The Girl from Ipanema. We asked Orlando to introduce us to some tunes which are not so familiar.
Here are two songs from two different Brazilian films. The first one is called A Felicidade by Antônio Carlos Jobim. A Felicidade from the movie Black Orpheus. It means happiness, and it's a song about the fragility of happiness. A felicidade é como a gota de orvalho numa pétala de flor. Brilha tranquila, depois de leve oscila e cai como uma lágrima de amor. Tristeza não tem fim. Felicidade, sim. A felicidade é como a pluma que o vento vai levando pelo ar. Voa tão leve, mas tem a vida breve. Precisa que haja vento sem parar. A felicidade do pobre parece a grande ilusão do carnaval. A gente trabalha um ano inteiro por um momento de sonho, pra fazer a fantasia de rei ou de pirata ou jardineira. E tudo se acabar na quarta-feira. Tristeza não tem fim. This next song is by Brazilian composer and poet Chico Buarque, who writes love pop songs with very political connotations, and these songs become hits on the radio down in Brazil. The song is also from a film, Ópera do Malandro, a recent Brazilian film, and describes the old-style malandro. The malandro is a character from the 40s and 50s who is a macho guy dressed slick and lived off of women. Chico says that this old style malandro has completely been absorbed into society. He's, you know, has disappeared. Maybe he has a family. Who knows? But that the new Malandro, the one who is acting as Malandro today, is not on the street, but in politics, government, and big business.
Eu quis fazer samba em homenagem à nata da malandragem que conheço de outros carnavais. Eu fui à Lapa e perdi a viagem que aquela tal malandragem não existe mais. Agora já não é normal o que dá de malandro popular, profissional, malandro com aparato de malandro oficial, malandro candidato a malandro federal, malandro com retrato na coluna social, malandro com contrato, com gravata e capital, que nunca se dá mal, mas o malandro pra valer não espalha, aposentou a navalha, tem mulher e filho e tral e tal. Dizem as más línguas que ele até trabalha, mora lá longe e chacoalha no trem da central. Para papá.
Orlando Haddad and his band Minos are at work on a second album. Their first was called Numja Azu, In a Blue Day. This is Fresh Air. Photojournalist Eli Reed wanted to know how residents of Beirut managed to go about their daily lives while surrounded by constant fighting. In 1983 and 84, he spent 4 months finding out. It wasn't the first time he witnessed fighting. The first gun battle he photographed was in Liberty City, Miami. His pictures of Central America for the San Francisco Examiner won a Nikon World Understanding Award and an Overseas Press Club Award for Best Photo Reporting. Eli Reed returned to Lebanon in 1987. He's collected 128 of his Beirut photographs in a new book titled Beirut, City of Regrets. Eli Reed got a lot of advice from journalists before his first trip to Lebanon. He told me the best advice was to just follow the rules. I asked him what that meant.
Well, in some ways, don't do anything stupid. Some people try to take shortcuts and think that they can get away with stuff. And if you're in there for the distance, if you're trying to really figure out what happens, I don't think that works too well. I mean, you have to move slowly and try to get an understanding of what's happening, not from what you've heard before, not from what even people have told you before. I mean, like, best thing I could do for myself when I go someplace like that is to just forget everything almost everything I've learned before. Forget your friends, forget your relatives, forget your office, just get in there and let yourself stay open for all the experiences that are going to happen to you.
You have a shot where there's a couple who's huddled against a wall protecting themselves during shelling, and they've temporarily abandoned their luggage and their pink baby carriage to protect themselves.
Well, yeah.
Now, where were you when you took this? Because you would be as vulnerable to the shelling as they were.
Yeah, well, what happened was, they were trying to, it was another one of evacuations. Like, there's people who have been evacuated, like, you know, four or five times or more when it gets too hot. And the baby was sort of buried underneath their arms trying to protect the baby. So it wasn't just protecting themselves. And it was so amazing, and you know, how people survive. I just, you know, I stood up and took, you know, I mean, the stuff happened. Everybody went down. I shot from sort of a standing position, and then I got down low also because I didn't want to get hurt.
Were you in the position of having to dodge bullets a lot as you were wandering around taking photos?
Yeah, there's a lot of situations where I didn't know if I was going to be seeing another sun come up.
The thing that always strikes me about photojournalists who are covering any kind of combat, it's just as everyone is running for shelter, they're out there taking photos of it.
Yeah, well, that's how you separate the journalists from the normal, you know, bright people. But you can't, but, you know, I mean, I'm not there out there all the time. There's times, you know, I'll decide, okay, today I'm going to be crazy. I'm going to do something, you know, stupid or whatever. Because, you know, it doesn't work if you don't come back with your pictures. You know, it's like, what is the point? There's a more important thing coming up, and that's, you know, we want a message, or not a message maybe, but you want to get this information that this is what it's really like. This is not a movie. This is not a game.
You know, I think most Americans really have trouble keeping track of all the different warring parties in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how carefully you researched the conflicts in Lebanon before going down there, and whether you wanted to rely more on instinct or more on background information when you were taking your photos.
Well, I rely on my instinct because, you know, you can read things about what happened before, and that doesn't apply necessarily to what's happening now. I mean, you can get a basic overview of what you're getting yourself into. But, you know, for one thing, if you're going to a place like, if I really looked too deeply, maybe I'd talk myself out of it. You know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to get there and see for myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you studied photography with W. Eugene Smith, and I was wondering if you sought him out.
I think anybody who was serious about photojournalism would seek Gene Smith out at the time.
Why did you want to study with him?
Because his dedication, the kind of photographs he took, you know, the kind of the respect he had for a human being, you know, not just for one particular group, but for the human being, and I wanted to come in contact with somebody who really is dedicated to making pictures that make a difference.
Did he give you any advice that stuck with you?
Well, there's a couple of kinds of advice that was gotten. I think most of the people who went through that workshop didn't come out the same way they went in. If they really, you know, stuck in there and listened, because things were more serious when I came out, more important. And there's one little technical thing was, I knew a lot of technical things before I went to the workshop, but one thing I was worried about overshooting film, and he told me that, well, if you at a certain point, and you're getting intense on a particular thing, and it's you really got this pressure on yourself and this intensity, and if you take that intensity off by maybe slowing down, maybe you put the camera away from your eye or something, you take that intensity away, maybe that situation, you don't get the peak, you don't get the real guts of it because you've let yourself relax. I mean, it's not a relaxing thing to do serious photography at all. You get really irritated very easily, except with your subjects, you know. And your subjects can do almost anything, but, you know, yourself, it's like, should, you know, rips into your stomach, you know.
So Smith wanted you to just go for that peak moment, to feel when it was and shoot then?
Well, not to stop yourself, you know. Every particular moment, it's like you can take it to, it's, there's nothing left of the moment because you're trying to capture it and film. And it's like, you know, some people say that a camera, you know, steals souls, and maybe it does. But if you get something out of it that explains that that can make people feel, then maybe somebody forgives you, you know, maybe not. But, you know, if you're going to do this thing, it means you have to take it very seriously.
You just shot what we might call a sequel to a series that Eugene Smith once did of a country doctor in a small town in Colorado. And you just did a series that's about to be published in Hippocrates magazine of a doctor in the same town who succeeded the doctor who Smith had shot. Did you go back and look at Smith's series of photographs before shooting your own?
Well, we had some, you know, we had a couple of books on Smith, and like if you're really into photojournalism, you know that series. And the thing is, to go back there and not to do what he did, actually, because you can't do what he did, you know. You know, you're not Gene Smith, you're Eli Reid. So what I tried to do was just to go in there, and there's certain pictures you're trying to get because you have an overall type picture of what he was about, you know. And you feel like really inadequate, you know, because I had about, you know, a week to do this, and it's still enough time if, you know, I mean, if you're in a perfect world, I'd have 3 months to do it. This is not a perfect world, so I had a week, and I felt I did the best I could. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the chance to go walk the streets that Mr. Smith walked, because he's really a special person to a lot of photojournalists.
You've taken photos in different parts of the world, photos of things that are very familiar to you, photos of things that are very unfamiliar to you. Do you ever use the camera just for personal documentation, for pictures of friends and family, or do you not like to mix the two?
No, I do. I photograph all the time. I mean, you know, it's I always have a camera with me, and it's you know your friends, right? So it's a lot easier to photograph your friends in some ways. And I don't know. It's if you do it right, then there isn't any difference. If you do it right, I mean, there has to be in a way, because you can. You know, you go into a situation that's not anything like what you're back in your so-called real world is like. But then you also take things from, like, you know, you go into a situation. There's this one picture that I took that's in a book. It's of this old man in this camp, Palestinian camp, and he's standing next to his bed, and there's a big hole in the wall from a shell that hit there, you know. And I ran into him on the street, and he took me up. He just grabbed my hand. I started shooting him, and he took my hand. I thought he wanted me to stop photographing him. But he just pulled me with him and led me around up these stairs and to his bedroom and then stood there and looked at me. And as if to say, yeah, take my picture, show what's happening to me. I mean, that's not the first time, I mean, that somebody's done that. But as I was shooting him, I was really connecting with my father. I mean, he could be anybody's father. So just a gentleman trying to survive, you know, in this horrible situation. And it's hard not to think about your family, your father, your friends, and that kind of thing. So there is sort of a connection. I don't think that connection is wrong.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks a lot, and I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Photojournalist Eli Reid. His work can be seen in the new book, Beirut, City of Regrets, published by Norton, and in the September issue of Hippocrates magazine. This is Fresh Air. Let's see how all things considered are shaping up. Alex Chadwick is guest hosting today. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
The Democratic Convention opens on Monday. Do you already have a reporter in Atlanta?
We do. Linda Wertheimer, our national political correspondent, is down there, and she'll kind of take a look at things today and on tonight's program. Let us know how things are getting going there.
What else are you covering?
We're also taking a look at those hearings that have been going on into that near-air disaster in Hawaii a couple of months ago. This is the one where the top peeled off the airplane. We'll have a report on that. The Nicaraguan ambassador has finally left the United States, booted out by the Reagan administration. And we are going to go to an auctioneer's convention.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker has the review of a new home video that he thought would be a sure bet, but things don't always play out the way you think they will.
I've always wanted to be a gambler, so when I got hold of a tape called So You Wanna Be a Gambler, I figured, all right, this is gonna be it. The heck with that 9-to-5, move out to Vegas for a year or so, amass that fortune, and then spend the rest of my life lying around reading Proust all day. It's kind of a common fantasy, isn't it? I even took it as a good omen that this series of four cassettes leads off with blackjack. Blackjack is my game. Didn't I spend much of my youth playing blackjack with my father and brothers for a penny a hand? Of course I did. I was psyched. Then I watched the tape. First of all, it was depressing. So You Wanna Be a Gambler is hosted by John Patrick, a sallow man with a sour expression. He's dressed in a purple sport coat and white turtleneck shirt, both of which look much too big for him. This instructional tape was filmed in an unnamed Atlantic City casino before an audience of silent, middle-aged gambling fans. Many of them look as if they're brooding on the money they lost last night at poker rather than the secret tips for gambling success that Patrick is promoting. And as far as those tips go, well, gee, I didn't know gambling was so complicated. John Patrick explaining his foolproof method of card counting in order to win at blackjack gave me a headache.
The idea of card counting, when you pick up a deck, there are 16 10-value cards. There are 36 non-10s, which means a ratio of small cards, which is non-10s, to large cards is 2 1/4 to 1, or 36 to 16. If I were to take the whole amount of 16 picture cards, 10-value cards, in a deck, lay them on the table, and lay two non-10s next to each card, what you've got is two small cards for every large card and four left over.
Patrick goes on like this for minutes on end. He calls up members of the audience to introduce them to his system, and when they goof, he makes fun of them. He doesn't come off as an especially nice man. My dream of making a quick kill as a professional card shark died a quick death watching this tape, so I suppose it performed a minor public service. As summer proceeds, there's a large number of new videocassette releases available, probably on the sensible assumption that any sane person would rather sit inside with the blinds drawn watching movies than go out in that insufferable sunlight. Among the latest are Fatal Attraction, the movie that made esteemed actress Glenn Close a mass-market star by turning her into a sex bomb psycho killer. Another major release is Nuts, in which Barbara Streisand tries to prove she isn't, to little avail. There's also Full Metal Jacket, director Stanley Kubrick's sharp, chilly interpretation of the Vietnam War. If you're looking for a family film, you could do worse than avoid the lines for Who Framed Roger Rabbit and rent Benji the Hunted. It's the latest in the live-action series about that fluffy little dog who's always getting into trouble. In their own very minor way, the Benji films, directed by Joe Camp, are good work, with Benji the Hunted the best I've seen. It uses very little dialogue, so even the youngest viewers can follow the fast-paced action, yet many adults I know are taken in by Benji's narrow escapes and winning little barks. As a video presence, Benji could teach John Patrick a few lessons.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Washington Post reporter Paul Hendrickson is in the middle of writing a biography of Robert McNamara, one of the chief architects of the war in Vietnam. McNamara refuses to talk about the war. He's such an elusive subject, yet such an overwhelming subject, Hendrickson isn't sure he'll finish the book. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Hendrickson about what he's learned so far and why he's considered giving up. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Vietnam War Story, a cable series he says is less sanitized than other TV portrayals of the war and much more powerful because of it. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Look What I Got, singer Betty Carter's new album. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.